Welcome and bienvenue, welcome. Fremde, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you, bleibe rest to stay. Welcome and bienvenue, welcome. Im Kabarett, au Kabarett, du Kabarett. Meine Damen und Herren,
good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 420A, December the 21st, 1979, and this is side one of the tape.
Do you feel good? Ich bin euer Conferencier. Je suis votre compère. I am your host and sage willkommen.
By the time you receive this tape, most of you, I'm sure, the Christmas holidays will be over, and you'll be ready to celebrate the coming of 1980, the 1980s. Of course, I wish all of you a happy new year. If you can make it happy, make each day happy, you're lucky. Don't look too far ahead this year, but take each day and grab what you can and make the most of it. The 1980s are going to be very interesting. I guess that is one of the words that I prefer to use at this time. Tom Wolfe, the author who recently did a book on the astronauts, was on the Today Show, talking about the 1980s with Tom Brokaw. And the trouble with our society, I believe, was epitomizing the kind of dialogue they were having. Wolf was lauding several things that would be happening in the 80s. He talked about the astronauts and the need for heroes, and that how much the moon trip meant to us at the time. They did it because of our intense hatred of the Soviet Union and antagonism towards the Soviet Union, and that we looked upon the space project as our answer to Sputnik, and we used these men as heroes. Tom Wolfe also talked about the return of aristocracy. That's why he called it the royal decade, the emergence of the royal class and the distinctions between classes. And then he talked about the need of more religion in the White House. Well, of course, these are the very things that have brought this decade or this era falling flat on its face all over the world. One is that we don't need heroes such as the moon shot, because the astronauts later went into large corporations and dissolved themselves into various places with their mental sicknesses, their divorces, their emotional problems, and the possible fakery even of the moonshot, that they didn't even go there. The lying and the deceptions of the entire era have been so gross and blatant, and we're paying the price now for all of that. We didn't need those kind of heroes, I don't believe. We don't need the aristocracy or the royal color that he's talking about. That's what these world revolutions are about, the front page headlines, the hatred of the United States, of America, the wider gap between the rich and poor, the rising awareness of the lower middle class, and the response of those people towards the rulers or the ruling class is not what we need. And I don't see how he thinks that we're going to install this royal purple era of aristocracy when they're falling flat on their faces. We don't need religion in the White House. We don't need religion anywhere. Religion, for the most part, and I do believe in God, which is separate from these formal religions, is a total fraud. The commandment, thou shalt not kill, is ignored, and the people doing the most budgets for defense, the most warmongering personalities, are also, incidentally, the most religious and attend church every Sunday. And there's this terrible contradiction of religion and weapons. And goodness knows, we don't need the preacher in the White House. And Tom Wolfe was saying we need social classes, that terms like redneck or plaid skirts, referring to middle-class children in private schools and so forth, would come out. I think it's the other way around. I think the secrecies are being broken open, and the embassies being broken into, and the papers can be read by everybody. We can't shred fast enough or lock up fast enough for the way things can be burned down or torn down. We don't need royalty or the royal purple in the ruling class, and we don't need more religion. I believe the 1980s is going to be a period of tremendous despair. I think we done very little with our education and have learned not much since World War One or Two. This is going to be the further rising of the have-nots, referred to always as the Third World, the guerrillas, the terrorists. I don't like any of those terms. They're waking up. They're catching on. The seams are falling apart in imperialism and fascism. I'll go through some of those heads of states that fell in the 70s. The seams are falling apart in the British royal ruling class, and the infiltration of spies and exposés and books of prominent people in their various kinky sex patterns, and servants write books. The walls have ears, and the tables are being turned. The media sells juicy stories about all kinds of relationships of famous people that had secrecy before. I can see a confrontation, a continuation of the warring period that's gone on, never ended, and the Vietnam experiment has been moved to the Middle East. Maybe it'll take 100 million people in the next 10 years that will be killed before a new generation wakes up. But so long as the newspaper, the television, and radio is controlled by the select few that represent the ruling class, if you don't have alternative press, alternative radio, each new generation will go on making the same mistakes, because the old generation hasn't sat back and analyzed their mistakes. They want to make the same ones over and over again. We'll go into the mistakes in Iran, what's happening. They can't sit back and analyze the errors of the past, and we just keep repeating them continuously, and I don't see any end to the cycle until some new minds or some new advisors come in and say, you're doing it the wrong way. I've been wanting to leave the country for the past 10 years, but circumstances have always come in that have forced me to stay here. And all this time I've been ashamed of what the United States has done. And when the embassies are burned and the demonstrations take place and headlines are against the United States and the major countries are afraid to stand by us, I am embarrassed by the dictatorships we've put in, the torture instruments we've had, the manipulations of the courts, the murdering of labor leaders, musicians, politicians, candidates, the president, heads of states of other countries. This country has been a total disaster in terms of moral responsibility, the reporting of the news media, the court system. It is a disgrace, and to live with it is to be a part of the breaking of the seams, the awareness of the people, how they've been ripped off, and to suffer the consequences of a lot of the things that have gone on. I've never liked it. I've never approved of it. That's why I've been on the radio and doing the research to expose the many ways that this country has been fouled up. The air, the food, the minerals, the chemicals, the manufacturers, everything is cheap and vulgar, and there isn't beauty in natural things around us, in natural life, in nature, and you have to find it, and you have to fight hard to hold it, and fight hard to keep your sanity and reject the cheap and the vulgar and the bad products in this country and the poisons in this country, poisons of body and mind. You have to be ever alert, working every day at twice the speed that you did the year before to avoid the pitfalls and the generalities and the cheapness and the avoidance of responsibility that people have in this country for the way their public officials act and respond. There's just too much news each week to cover in these tapes to do the kind of job I would like to do. It used to be that I could get on KLRB for an hour a week or 45 minutes and cover some of the major stories that I thought were important. And those of you who have the radio show tapes going back, this is 8 years now, or the cassette tapes going back the last couple of years, or take them continuously, can take certain names as I update them through this next year and rush through these names. You have that advantage. Other people just will not be familiar with them because there's too much news coming out every week. It's the comparison between seeing a Norman Rockwell painting where you get a visual image of a particular statement, a single statement that you could do in the past when times were slower, and now the radio tapes and the research is more like Jackson Pollock. You're going to have to take the drips of the paintings, mostly brown and black with a little bit of white and a lot of red for blood, and take it and get the total picture from the drippings, and that's the way these tapes will be. Escalating through the year, I can see the way the news is going, and my desk is accumulated. We're into what is like a pointillism or an abstract, a modern abstract of pieces that will give you a picture if you want to see it. And if you like what you see or hear, then order the back tapes if you don't have them to complete your picture. Several weeks ago, I ran down a list of important people from a historical point of view who died in the 1970s, who affected our lives in many ways, such as Charles de Gaulle and Aristotle, Onassis, and Howard Hughes, and so forth. And then alongside that list, I gave a suggestion of 9 or 10 names of people that I wouldn't mind seeing disappear as soon as possible in 1980. That wasn't very nice to suggest a possible hit list. I only believe that if those 10 people were dead tomorrow, it may save the lives of 100 million people within the next 10 years, that they're hell-bent on war of any kind, and it would be no loss. It would, if I were alive in Germany in 1932, before the election of Adolf Hitler, the time of the Reichstag fire, and was able to say, investigate the Reichstag, I might have said, let's see what Mr. Himmler's doing, and Adolf Hitler and Mr. Reinhard Heydrich, Martin Bormann, Adolf Eichmann, Joseph Mengele's, Hermann Goering, Joseph Goebbels, Rudolf Hess. Let's see what these guys are doing. And if we got rid of those 9, what would we have in terms of a war and the persecutions and the displacement of people and the loss of 80 million people and the way they died and the insanity of torture and experimentation that continued as soon as the overt war was over? The Cold War began immediately. I know it's a mistake to get on the air to give the names of public enemies. It's somebody felt that, wrote to me that it could be dangerous and non-productive. I also do it for another reason. I use these tapes sometimes as a sounding board for a response, because when you mail out, you don't know where they're going or who they're going to. And very often after I do a tape, you'll see a response in the news, like a cause and effect relationship, and I don't know how it's coming down or if it's coincidental. But right after I made that tape naming this particular list of people that we could do without, about 10 days later, I got a phone call just 2 days ago from a woman talking long distance. I knew she was from long distance, and we talked quite a while. Money didn't seem to be the problem. And after 30 minutes, she said that she was from St. Louis, and she was in Missouri. And she asked me, she said her parents were anarchists in the old country in Europe, and she was kidnapped and brought to this country and was raised by anarchists, and that she was with 2 different families, and that she had been separated by them and kidnapped by the FBI. And they had her, and she wanted to get away from the FBI because she just hated the FBI terribly. She read my article, The SLA is the CIA, and she knew that I was the only person that could get her in touch with Marxists or Leninists or anarchists. And I talked to her quite a while, because I know that when I sent to the FBI for Freedom of Information Act, my articles in The Realist and other ones from Playgirl and We were in there. They sent me copies of my own article, so that these are available to the FBI and the intelligence community. But this woman kept saying, well, don't you know, can you get me back to my family? They've gone underground, and I want to be with the Marxists. I said, I don't know any Marxists. I want to be with the Leninists. You know, can you get me? And the thing is that I talked to her for a long time and realized that these people wanted to know who I was working with, or did I have a group or an organization they like to keep track. And this call, and I got the conversation going with her, gave me the link of knowing that they said, well, what is Mae Brussel up to? Does she have a hit list like the people in Iran for going after the Shah's family, his nephew being killed, and contracts out, or so forth? It's a sounding board, and it sounds a little bit dangerous for Mae Brussel to be on the air saying these renowned people would be better off dead. I really mean they would be better off dead, but I don't know anybody who's going to do the job, and I'm not inciting anybody to do it, because I doubt if there are that many people out there that even can see now. They'll see it 20 or 30 years from now and wish maybe they had done it, but right now they can't see how individuals affect the course of history. And that is very important, because individuals do affect history for better or for worse. And some of these people are polluting the earth terribly with their technology, their know-how, their ability to organize and mobile around the forces of hate and envy and greed, and accumulate the kind of power that creates weapons and chemicals to destroy all the decent people that are minding their own business and doing the things that they like to do. Many of you know about the mail harassment I've had from time to time. This last month, I got two checks back from my Bank of America account, and one was torn, ripped off the corner in a very funny, curved fashion, just obviously mutilated and torn. And the other one that was made out to the post office for $25 was burnt. One-third of it, the corner, was burnt. And I know that postal workers don't smoke cigarettes while they're handling the mail, and usually at the bank they're not sitting there smoking. So I sent a letter to the Beverly Hills branch of the Bank of America and enclosed my checks and asked the reason that they were in this condition. And other checks in that same batch were very badly mutilated, as if they'd been carried around in a pocket for a long time. And one was just addressed to a farm center right down below the house, a mile away, you know, for some clothing. So it couldn't have been carried that far. And I got a letter back December the 11th from Bank of America saying, "We apologize for the mutilated condition of your two checks. Check 220 was torn somewhere in transit from the endorsing branch to us. And check 210 was burned because of a malfunction in the bank messenger's car. The problem has been attended to." I guess the car was fixed. "Once again, we're sorry. We'll do our best to return your checks in good condition." So somebody is carrying around or going through my checks to see who I'm paying or who I'm writing to. And some are burned and some are mutilated. They're not very careful about the espionage they're doing, or else the workers are certainly they're not as trained as they used to be. They're more careless. They also don't care. But I do send out trial balloons sometimes, and I appreciate your concern about me or my safety, and always write if you have any doubt or suggestions. But a lot of times I do these things for a reason and get the response back that I expect will be following. David Rockefeller is stepping down as chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, January the 1st, head of the nation's third largest bank, but certainly one of the most famous banks. Recently, it's been the center of a controversy. The Rockefeller family was responsible for sending the doctors down to the Shah of Iran, of the medical treatment of bringing him to the United States. Chase Manhattan has been the principal bank for the Pahlavi family for their billions of dollars that were intertwined also with the Rockefeller oil money in Iran. David Rockefeller began his first job at the bank in the foreign department of Chase National Bank in 1946. The Rockefellers had a big role in arming Adolf Hitler as our great bulwark against communism, and then when the war was over, they were in the thick of rebuilding Germany and putting the Nazis back into power and setting the stage for this new fiasco that'll take place in the Middle East, probably right there, World War III. As head of the Chase Manhattan Bank, David Rockefeller didn't help the bank bring the Shah in. It was just one personal commitment that may boomerang if the money could be drawn out of there, and I've talked about that on other tapes. There was a cartoon by Mike Peters in the Dayton Daily News this last week, and it's got a picture of the Shah of Iran passing a cup, and it says, "He's sick, homeless, and unloved, abandoned by his friends, afraid to show his face. Let him know there's someone who cares, someone who wants to help him. He doesn't need much, a chauffeur, a cook, a gardener, the bare necessities. Please help. Adopt a Shah." And then it's got a space up above, "Adopt a Shah. Yes, I would like to adopt a Shah." And it's that little squares. "I'd like to make a contribution towards an island retreat, a villa, a yacht." And you put your name and your address and your Swiss bank account number. And it said, "For more information, write to Henry Kissinger, Chase Manhattan Bank, New York, New York, 10022. So the Chase and the Shah and Kissinger, that combined, we haven't heard the rest of that. There's an article in the New York Times just last week, "Behind the Chase's New Vigor, David Rockefeller, Chairman of Chase Manhattan." Now, they were lauding him as being an important person on the board and his prestige at the institution. If he intended to step down January the 1st, the New York Times had no inkling of it, the man behind the Chase Bank. But I think that December 9th article, long article on the strength of the bank and the strength of David Rockefeller, but there's been a big turn in the last few weeks, and I think Chase would be very nervous about the investments that the Shah has in their bank. Walter Scott answered a question somebody wrote in the Sans A Mercury and the Washington Post also carried it. There was a question about Henry Kissinger involved in an affair known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. What are the Dead Key Scrolls, that this person asked? And the answer was, when Kissinger was Secretary of State, he had a dead key attached to his phone, a button of sorts that permitted his secretary to monitor and transcribe phone calls without the other party knowing what was going on. Those transcripts are called the Dead Key Scrolls. Several weeks before he left the Ford administration, Kissinger had the notes moved to the home in New York estate of the late Nelson Rockefeller, Kissinger's patron. Kissinger subsequently donated the notes to the Library of Congress on the condition that nobody can see them for 25 years. They're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act and so forth. So that here was a public servant as the Secretary of State who was transcribing everybody's conversations, who's left them on a private estate of the late Nelson Rockefeller. And again, the Chase, Manhattan, Standard Oil, Secretary of State, whatever he was doing as a public servant under salary to us, he could blackmail every head of state in every country or try to and put them in the hands of the Rockefeller family. Kissinger was under the salary to Rockefeller before he became Secretary of State. He married his wife at the height of Watergate when she was a full-time employee to the Rockefellers, and when he was out of government service, he was paid by the Rockefellers. And while he was Secretary of the State, he could transcribe all his information, goodness knows who he was talking to, and turn it over to the personal family of the Rockefellers. So that's enough blackmail to last 1,000 years. I'm sure 25 years from now, what comes out will be very edited to make Henry Kissinger look good. And the juicy parts, such as J. Edgar Hoover used to take from people, will remain as control for the Rockefeller family and their investments wherever they go. Last Friday, when I made the tape saying that I believed that the Shah was under house arrest at the Army base, there were newspaper articles. One, Shah's health worsens. Another, physician tending Shah believes his condition is worse. Another article about the Shah's health may be worse. His attorney says in court, why did he leave so fast? That Friday he was very sick, and then all of a sudden he was flown out, and as I say, he was under house arrest. He ends up with Torrijos in Panama and is moved tighter into what I referred to as a locked-up condition of the drug connection, the links of Jimmy Carter to Robert Vesco, and the narcotics traffic, that there's more to the Shah's being moved out of office and being sequestered than has yet surfaced and may never surface. But I'm sure the way journalists are going today that they will delve into this shortly. One of the reasons he left town so fast was that there was a lawsuit that Lackland Air Force Base, he was going to be served with papers to appear. It had to do with an organization, the Bell Helicopter Company, a $6 million lawsuit, their international company, that was filed, and the Shah's attorneys wanted to quash the subpoena. They were going to make the former monarch give a deposition in the $6 million lawsuit, and he was to be served at Lackland Air Force Base. Well, Bell Helicopter is owned by Mr. Miller, head of our Treasury, Secretary of the Treasury now, and two of those hostages that are going to be tried for spies if we don't declare World War III to avoid the spy trial in Iran are employees of Bell Helicopter, which is nothing but a spy agency from A to Z. Two of the employees of the Secretary of the Treasury are over among those 50 members of the embassy, or were swept up as spies when the embassy was taken. Now, this suit was filed in 1976. There were 69 former pilots who said they were fired because they organized a union at Bell Helicopter International to get terms of a contract. They were training Iranian military pilots, but they wanted to belong American style to a union, and the Shah didn't want it. James W. Lane, attorney for the pilots, said he subpoenaed the Shah to get him to tell what he knew about the labor dispute, which took place in Iran. Then Rockefeller's lawyers swept into town, and the Shah's lawyers said that giving the deposition, in quotes, would disrupt his recovery from prior therapy and make extremely serious threat to his health. Well, very often people get a sickness when they're subpoenaed for a trial, and the Shah got sick, and the doctors came, and they flew him out of town, but they flew him to a very safe place, the safe place, of course, being in the arms of Trujillo, with his notorious links to Richard Nixon and Hunt and Liddy and Operation Intercept and Robert Vesco and the World Narcotics Traffic and Counterintelligence. So even though the Shah is photographed at the bar, this morning's paper, yesterday's paper had a picture of him looking suntanned and happy and so forth, he went out of the country into the arms of Trujillo, which is just the same as a military base, but right in the arms of his narcotics traffic companions, so that poor health was the Rockefeller doctor that flew out, and they got him quickly over to Panama. Robert Vesco is an interesting character. I did a little bit about him last week. Vesco had been charged with mafia connections and trafficking in illegal drugs, and he was wanted in this country because he stole $224 million from investment overseas. But he has not been brought back. And I briefly mentioned last week the Carter connections to Capricorn Records, just briefly, and the narcotic connections in Georgia, and the Billy Carter connections to Robert Vesco. And there's a whole can of worms of narcotics traffic that's taking place now. It's been going on continuously, and it's probably the biggest business, bigger than the defense industry or even oil or ammunition. The narcotics traffic profits and the flow of narcotics is never properly identified with the heads of states and how they move. There was an article just this last week, French Connection is out, the Mideast drug traffic is in. And it goes on to say that the Middle Eastern connection, using laboratories in Turkey and opium from Iran, is being processed, and the Southeast Asian narcotic traffic is slowing down. The one that we escalated the war for, the heroin traffic, and now Europe is getting 90% of its narcotics from the Middle East. There's a comparison between Turkish and Iranian opium and their morphine base and so forth, and the Mediterranean laboratories, the flow of the Turkish traffic. And now this article in the LA Times says the important thing is that the Turkish traffickers have their own laboratories. They're cutting out the middlemen and making it extremely difficult for remnants of the French connection to find morphine base. Iran can produce its own heroin. A number of Iranians have been arrested in the United States and London, and most of the opium that enters the Middle Eastern connection is from Pakistan, Afghanistan, but this crop is pouring in. So if you squeeze out the middleman, you squeeze out the Marseille connection, a lot of people get hurt. And I believe that the flow of traffic of narcotics into The Hague and Holland, West Germany, France, Italy, and Austria is being affected at a level, it would be, you could do a whole year's study on just the current flow of the narcotics. But I believe that one of the reasons for removing the Shah and his family from power in Iran has a lot to do with the flow of opium and heroin as much as any other reason, because the Savak could have protected him if the President of the United States, Carter, had wanted to. But by easing the Shah out, the flow of traffic goes into different hands. Another article this last week, Mexico drug use on the rise. Another one, West Germany struggles with narcotics. The narcotic problem is terrific. Who owns the flow of it is a battle line which is clearly drawn and has to do with even removing heads of state. But rest assured that when the Shah is down with Trujillo, and that's the French connection, that they will regroup themselves, that gang that are linked with Interpol and so forth and are competing with the Middle East connection. There will be a narcotics battle at all levels and piracy at the sea. And I think that putting the Shah down with Trujillo is a really good place for him with his drug connections, and they can make their own drug wars while we sit back and watch. Of course, the drug wars affect all of us. It affects the people on the street, their inability to reason. It's like the opium wars in China that made people slaves. We become slaves, our young people, our best minds, and we get burglaries and muggings and murders. And the pain of the narcotics traffic is felt in every city in America. You can see it on people's faces and everywhere. And there's no conscience about importing narcotics throughout the world and doping people so that they're unable to think, unable to defend themselves, and be non-productive in work programs. Somebody should surely come out with better articles now on Jimmy Carter and Dr. Peter Byrne and the Capricorn Records and the drug traffic coming out of Georgia, the state that he was the governor, and the drug connections that got him to become president in the first place, starting with the Allman Brothers and the concerts and the drug traffic in the South.